So, Jeff, do you know anything about turkeys and or polecats?
I don't know a whole lot, but I know just a little.
Like wild turkeys?
No, wild turkey is pretty good, but
No,
we're going to
not
talk about a
wild
different
turkey.
turkey.
Right. Okay.
So, what I know about turkeys and polecats is that they are, for the most part, sworn enemies. They don't like each other. The polecats try to attack the turkeys try to attack the polecats back. And researchers who put the two together have discovered that even if you put just a polecat model in with the turkey will attack it.
Just instinctive response.
Instinctive response. Just see it, do it. But if you put a little tape recorder inside that dummy and it makes the cheep, cheep, cheep of the turkey chicks, the mother turkey will start to embrace this polecat model and will take care of it. And so it has this response, sort of this, what the author of the book that we're going to talk about today has called a click-whir response, where it's just mechanical. You hit the switch and a response happens, and this animal, under the right circumstances, does something that's completely opposite to its normal behavior.
Almost Pavlovian.
Exactly, Pavlovian. And so we may think of the turkey as being kind of an unintelligent, stupid animal that has this response, but we're going to talk today about why people often respond in a very similar manner.
Right, but people are not as delicious.
No.
Not that I've tried.
That
I
is a scary thought, Chris.
know. Speaking of scary thoughts, you told me about the a little follow-up to last week. I kept droning on about the Pomodoro method, but you told me about this other method. What is this other method?
Well, I happened to run across in the past couple of days somebody that talked about the Pelco method. And the Pelco method, according to the author, and we'll put a link in the show notes so you can go read this if our listeners want to, talked about people who grew up in Finland, which was near Russia. And so they were in constant fear of invasion and attack by the Russians. And so they learned to work well under the threat of fear. You know, that drove them. And so he says that the Pomodoro method is ineffective. If you really want to be effective, you don't use a tomato timer, you use a grenade timer. And not only do you use a grenade timer, but you put the time to an unknown value somewhere between 5 and 25 minutes. And that way you have to always work under the fear that your time is going to run out. So get on with it, do it now, be effective.
At least 3 fingers less effective than the Pomodoro method.
Right. There, you may not be able to give it thumbs up after you're done with this.
That's right. Well, that is scary, and I think I'll stick with the tomato, I gotta say.
Okay. Does sound a little
It
safer, I will
does.
admit.
It's, yeah, definitely safer. So what is this book we're talking about today? Because this was, you definitely brought this up, and I definitely was like, I have no idea what this is. And then later I figured that I actually had read this book.
Well, the book is called Influence, the Psychology of Persuasion. And it's by Robert Cialdini.
With a
And
C.
with a C at the beginning, Cialdini.
Yep.
And I can't remember exactly how I came across this book, but reading through it triggered a lot of ahas. And I said, boy, this is stuff that had just never occurred to me. It was an insight that was new to me. And it talks about how we, like the turkey, responding to the cheep, cheep, cheep of the chick, how we mechanically respond to things. We have built-in mental shortcuts that we make use of to make life go easier, to make interactions go smoother. And that either we can use that for good, we can use it for evil. We're not going to talk too much today about whether these things are generally good or evil. They can, you know, like technology, can be used both ways.
Right.
But I think it's important, especially for engineers who are focused on the outcome of the physical world, how the universe responds, understand that there are things going on in the social world, why they go on, and just to have an awareness of that so they can start to understand why events happen the way they do.
Right. And a lot of this is learned behavior, too. That's another important point, I think, is that it's not necessarily, you know, you're not preventing this. You really can't prevent a lot of this stuff. I mean, a lot of the behaviors that this influence book talks about is just learned through social constructs. I mean, it's through your parents, it's through your community. And then people take these things that you've learned either directly or indirectly. You know, maybe you learn to look both ways across before you cross the street, right? They're not using that one specifically, but it's that kind of learned behavior that they're then using and turning around in order to, you know, engineer a situation and try and direct the output how they want it to be. And I guess the thing I'm trying to say is it's like sales. It's really and that's a big part of this book is persuasion and sales, right?
Right. And whether we like it or not, we have to operate within that world. We enjoy technical solutions, but those technical solutions are only valuable and get sold in the marketplace if they solve a problem for a person. And to convince that person to buy the product or try the product or to embrace the product, somebody has to persuade them to do so.
Right. Yeah, it's not necessarily like you said, it's not good or bad. It's just persuasion. You know, how do you change someone's mind? How do you have them see your point of view? And that's part of what we're talking about here.
Right. And so we're going to talk about in the same sort of structure that the book talks about. They talk about six facets of influence. And those are, I'll just list them real quickly: reciprocity, consistency, liking, authority, scarcity, and social proof.
Yep.
And if you're looking for a mnemonic to remember those, if you walk away from this and go, I'll never remember those six, I use the mnemonic RCLASS, RCLASS, for reciprocity, consistency, liking, authority, scarcity, and social proof.
Yeah.
And so these are all, each one of these things all makes sense if you consider how we as humans came to sort of dominate the earth. We needed to work together. Reciprocity allowed us to work together. I would give up something now, you would give it back to me later. We needed consistency, so I knew I could count on you and you could count on me. We needed liking because we tend to like those who are similar to us. And that was okay because we were usually the team fighting on the same side. And so I'm not going to go through all of them, but there are definite reasons that these traits that we have make sense in terms of allowing us to work together and accomplish more than we could on our own.
Yeah, there's actually an entire field of evolutionary psychology and just where this stuff comes from. And this book kind of touches on a lot of that stuff, I think.
Yeah, the reviews if you go through Amazon, the reviews on this book, those who've been through a lot of this go, well, this is a pretty simplistic book. And they're sort of more advanced in their analysis of it. For those like me who came to it and really weren't aware of these issues, this book was good. It sort of hits a wide range of it hits these six facets from a wide range of directions, and it has pretty good research notes with it. So you know that this author is not making it up. By the way, he happens to be a PhD from, I think it's Arizona State University, and is really well recognized for his work in this area.
Yeah, yeah. I think another really important thing about this too is that we're not going to actually talk about the sales side of things because, you know, this is a book that, you know, could be used by salespeople, could be used by marketing. But also you have to remember is that engineering has tons of this stuff just in everyday interactions, right? If people think about, you know, you have an idea, maybe you're working in a group and three different people are trying to implement an idea they have. Well, you know, there is obviously going to be a best answer technically, but sometimes there's very equivalent answers, and maybe for whatever reason you want to have yours implemented. I don't know if you want, a legacy at your company, or you just, you know, people can have lots of reasons. And it's not necessarily that you should use this, you know, this influence for good or evil. It's just that this is a part of any social construct. It's if you're in a social situation where you're working with other people, which is most engineers, you're going to encounter these in some way or another. And we'll talk about a lot of these. I mean, you'll see these also when you're being sold to. So, you know, that is the sales side, but often engineers are talked to by vendors. The vendors, you know, bring in their wares, and they try and convince you that you should buy this, or, you know, you should buy services. So there really is a myriad of applications specific to engineering that is quite relevant to this book, and I think that people are going to like it.
Absolutely. I've been in those situations where someone's trying to sell me something or convince me of something, and I'm following the logic. I'm trying to follow the logic very carefully, and all of a sudden I've gone, this is heading somewhere I don't like. But I look at the logic and I go, I can't understand how it is we got here and why I feel uncomfortable about where this conversation is going. And some of these six facets that we're going to talk about today explain how someone got me there to that situation, and why my need to be consistent or my need to reciprocate led me to something where I felt like I had to do something that I really didn't want to do.
Right. And I feel like in full disclosure, I come from a family of salespeople, actually. I'm the first engineer in my family, but
I am so proud of you, Chris.
Oh yeah. I broke the mold. I still have lingering bits of salesperson in me, but yeah, my father, my grandfather, both salesmen. I think my great grandfather might have been as well. So
wow,
yeah, definitely broke the mold.
Well, we can all pretend that we don't have to worry about sales, but the reality is, even if you're the type that says, "Let's just compete on technical merit. I'll put my machine up against your machine, or my circuit up against your circuit, and let the best circuit win." But in reality, somebody who's playing the game is going to go, I bet I can influence the judge.
Yeah.
I bet I can get them to like me better or to consider me longer. And that's the person that's going to move up the ladder. And as long as you're okay with it, that's fine. But don't be upset later on when you look back, you know, 10 years down your career and go, how come those guys are climbing up the ladder and I'm not?
Right.
It may be technical merit, but it also may be their ability to influence others.
Right. And we can, we'll talk about that later. We were just talking before we recorded the show that we'll have an upcoming show about ethics, and I'm sure we can touch on that at that point. You're right. I mean, there are people that are, you know, that are interested in moving up and out of engineering, or maybe even just up in engineering. And there is a really big component of that. You know, any job where you're interacting with people, it eventually becomes there's political points to it, and there's all kinds of mess that most engineers don't want to think about, right? Because we're often focused on the technical solution, but oftentimes in order to implement the technical solution you want, or even just to maintain your job sometimes, you experience these situations, and it's just an unfortunate side effect of being human, you know? That sounds terrible, but it's just, you know, sometimes you got to deal with people, and hopefully this book will help.
And again, engineers are human, contrary to popular belief.
Correct. Yes. Correct. That is correct, Jeffrey.
So let me set up just a few sort of side notes before we get into this conversation. One is the book ignores the concept of self-interest. That is, it's not really influencing somebody. If you tell them, go pick up $1,000. They go, okay, there's no deal to be made. That's just self-interest. So that's not really influence, and we're not going to deal with it. It's assumed that people will act in their own self-interest, or what they perceive to be their own self-interest. The other is a constant component of a lot of this is what's called perceptual contrast. And that is, you can get somebody to anchor on a number. So like when you're negotiating a salary, they always say, don't be the first to mention a number. because as soon as somebody mentions the number, then everybody anchors to that number, and you're going to argue about 5,000 up or down from that number.
That's right. Yep. That's why you always start at 200,000.
Right. Unless you think you're worth four.
Oh, good point. I didn't think of that. I've just been anchoring at 200, huh?
Ah, haven't been thinking big enough, Chris.
Yeah, I guess so. Why stop there?
Right. Or if you go in, you buy clothes, the salesman will always try to sell you the suit first. Why the suit first? Well, because after you spent 150 or 250, or, you know, depending on how nice a suit you've got, the shirt for $50 is going to look pretty cheap, or right. The belt for $25 is going to look cheap in comparison. You're going to go, hey, I just got done spending $350. What's another 50 for a nice belt?
Right.
Or actually, 50 sounds pretty much for a nice belt. 25, let's say.
Hmm.
So,
luckily, I only buy T-shirts, so everything looks expensive to me.
Right.
T-shirts and jeans from Walmart. That's my deal.
I do like those outfits. They're much more comfortable than suit and tie.
Oh, yeah.
So these facets are four conditions, or four aspects of them. They're nearly automatic. We have trouble controlling them. They're fed generally by uncertainty, insecurity, emotional needs, things we want to mask. And so we rely on them because we're unsure about what's going on. They're easily exploitable by those who know how to do so. So you shouldn't feel bad about seeing somebody use it against you. We're all susceptible. And unfortunately, they do provide power to those who know how to exploit them. So just as a quick example of the shortcut aspect of it, if you walk into a wine store or a liquor store and you look for wine and you don't know anything about wine, what are you going to get?
Me personally, I'd probably pick up a box wine, a nice blush. Well, maybe.
Let's say this was before you and Mrs. Gamble got married and you were trying to impress her and you didn't know exactly what kind of wine she liked, but
yeah.
You didn't want to look like you didn't know what kind of wine you liked.
Right.
Well,
I know where you're going with this. I mean, I'd probably, try and pick up a more expensive bottle. I'd probably assume that, you know, if it's more expensive, it's a little more rare. Or it's probably worth more for some reason, right?
Exactly. And in general, that's true. We tend to find that more rare things cost more and are worth more. So you go look for the more expensive bottle of wine. So that's a shortcut we use in the face of uncertainty. So that's the kind of thing we're talking about.
Like a rule of thumb almost, right?
Yeah.
Engineers love rules of thumb. I personally, I can't get along without them. My thumbs are everywhere.
Unless you've been using the POCO method, in which case you may not have any.
Good point. Good point.
All right. So are you ready to head through the six facets of influence?
Yes.
All right.
What's first?
First is reciprocation, which is the idea that we should try to repay in kind what another person has provided us.
You know, that reminds me. I owe you $5, Jeff.
Do you? I don't remember that, but I'm quite happy to hear that.
Yeah, you'll probably owe me $5 after that, though.
Well, that'd be okay.
Yeah.
But we tend to think about those. If you do me a favor and I don't return the favor.
Right. Shame. Upon you.
I'm going to be a moocher or an ingrate.
Right. Yeah, and I've seen this before. I had this recently, actually. I had, you know, very nice vendor. You know, he helps me out with a lot of stuff. He invited me to go, you know, ride on a boat. And it was very nice. And I ended up turning him down because I'm not much of a bathing suit person myself. But, But yeah, I mean, it's that kind of thing, right? I mean, he offered me, you know, to go hang out on a boat, drink some beers, and I don't think it was necessarily I know the guy. It wasn't like a tit for tat kind of thing, like, oh, well, you know, come ride on this boat, and we'll go sign some papers for you to buy tons of parts, right? It's just a sales method. I mean, it's just a getting to know your customers.
Right.
So.
But, well, this aspect is very helpful because it allows us, like I said earlier, it allows me to forego something immediately in return for something more later. I will not go out and work in my field today. I will help you build a barn and in return, you will come back later and help me build a barn.
Mm.
And we can both build barns that neither of us could do by ourselves.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's very helpful.
Yeah, it's just a sense of community as well. I mean, it's really baked into the social fabric. It's a, you know, you feel empathy towards your neighbors, and it's actually baked into a lot of religions as well. I mean, being good to your neighbors is a very common theme throughout religions and just social fabric, I think.
Right. And for most people, the sense of obligation, if someone's done you a favor, you must return the favor. It's a very strong...
Right. It's a virtue.
It's a virtue.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So as an example of how this gets played, think about the envelopes you get from charities asking you for money.
Right.
And so you'll often find that inside they have their little sheet that says, this is who we are, this is what we do, this is why you should give to us, this is the benefit we provide to society. And they throw in an address label or a notepad,
yep,
or a key ring. Well, that's costing them money. Why,
yeah,
why are they giving away money? Well, the reason is because it doubles the contribution rate.
So people, the money coming back to them, you mean? Like once people, yeah, decide to donate, it's more?
Yeah, people say, oh, you gave me an address label. I owe you something in return. You've,
right,
you've done a favor for me. Now I must reciprocate.
Right.
You go, are people that silly? Absolutely.
And it might not be conscious either, right? I mean, it could just be like a, you know, it could just be a statistical thing over a large group. Whereas, you know, maybe a group of 100 would have each given $10. Maybe that group of 100 now all give $20. And, you know, it adds up because you're probably sending out many, many, many of those things. And so it all gets eaten up in that cost, right?
Right. Right. People have found that if you add a sticky note to a survey, that it increases survey response by 50%.
Sticky note, eh?
Just, yeah, like a post-it.
It has to have something written on it or no?
Yeah, just the fact that you took enough time to handwrite a post-it note and put it on the memo or the survey and say, hey, please take a look at this and do something with it. The response rate goes up 50%.
Wow.
We have a strong sense of obligation.
Yeah, I've actually seen they actually have robots now that'll actually, instead of printing something, they'll actually have a robot that they've taught handwriting to. And because it's the same kind of thing. If someone takes time to handwrite something, it seems more sincere. And of course, you probably can't tell it's a robot because it's a handwriting robot. And it's pretty good at what it does.
Right.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's just it's a perception thing, right? It's a perception of someone caring more.
Right. So when somebody greets you at Walmart, at the front, you'll see greeters at the front of the stores.
Yeah.
Why are they doing that? Well, because as soon as you say yes, you've gone, somebody's shown me kindness.
Mm.
I must return the kindness. It's not, I mean, it may be because they want to be socially generous, but it also makes money for them.
Yeah. That's why I buy my jeans there. Man, you figured it out. Now I know.
I just had a sense.
Yeah. It's those old people. I love them. They're adorable. That's interesting. So what about like, maybe as an engineer then, so like I said, with the sales thing, or if they take you out for a lunch or out for drinks or something like that, they would think that maybe you'd be more likely to think of them. Is that kind of the idea?
Yeah. We'll talk a little bit later, in terms of liking, because you tend to like people that way, but we also have this sense of reciprocation. So in a business situation, somebody may loan you equipment. You're talking to a vendor and they go, hey, we'll just loan you the equipment for a few days.
Yeah.
Or they'll take you to lunch, or they'll say, hey, we'll provide you with some information. Yeah, I'll give Joe a call and have him provide you with the information you need. All those little things, even though there's no money being exchanged in that particular part of the deal,
right,
causes a sense of obligation that makes us later feel obliged to return the favor. We have to pay that favor back.
Interesting. So what about from the engineering side then? So if you were an engineer trying to convince someone of your point, then otherwise, would it be like offering advice or help when not asked? I mean, like, that's the thing. It kind of ends up coming down to if you're just a nice person, you might give this stuff away anyways, right? I mean, you might be willing to mentor a young engineer, or you might be willing to help, stay late and help someone troubleshoot a problem. But you know, you're probably not expecting these things in return, right? I mean, it could just be you're a good person.
Oh, absolutely. And if you're a good person, that's fine. You can't turn down all offers of favors because we need that. We need that community to get things done.
Right, right.
So that's why it's so difficult. It's the same difficulty of trying to go on a diet. You know, it's not like giving up cigarettes where you can drop them forever. You may go on a diet, but you still have to eat. You can't get around the fact you need that food every day.
Right, yeah. You can't give up social interaction or else you probably won't be employed for very long unless you're really good.
Right.
Yeah, but at the same time, you're not trying to be Don Corleone, you know, and I give you a favor.
Right, right. So I will tell you, there's a switch on this reciprocation that we might not originally think of, but makes us really effective and really hard to get around.
A switch? What does that mean?
There's a tactic that people may or may not be doing intentionally, but if they are doing it intentionally, Cialdini calls it reject then retreat.
Oh.
So I may want you to do a favor for me, and I may say, Chris, if you will loan me $200 today, I will pay you back in 10 years.
Okay.
And you may say, that's hardly a favor.
Yeah, I'd say, Jeff, you can get the heck out of here.
Right. So once you've rejected my initial offer of favor, then I retreat. I go, well, not something. So how about $5, and I'll pay you $6 next week. And you may, if as long as the original offer was not so ridiculous as to be seen as insincere. Now I've put a even larger onus on you because I have compromised my original request, and you have to reciprocate with your own compromise.
Oh, okay. So it's a feeling of obligation, right? It's a
right.
Hmm.
So in the book, Robert Cialdini says that this strategy is three times more effective than just the favor request alone, as long as the initial demand is seen as reasonable.
Wow. So that might be like if a vendor's like, well, can I see the entire bomb from your product? I just want to see where all the opportunities are. And you're like, no, I can't give you that. But then, well, how about just the op amps for me, or, you know, all the linear valves for you or whatever they are, Jeff.
Right.
I still don't know what you do. Sorry.
And for those who might not be familiar with the abbreviation, there, bill of materials bomb, not the BOMB,
not like the Ben Stiller bomb 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 bomb. Right.
Right. So if you want to know more about reciprocity, you can read the book or go online. There are quite a few people who've covered this book and done reviews. But that's one of the big ones. Probably the biggest one is that sense of reciprocity.
Mm. Is that the same anecdote he uses with the Girl Scout cookies, or is that later?
That is the retreat. Yes, the reject and retreat.
Right. Go ahead.
He got asked to spend $5 or $10 on Girl Scout cookies, and he didn't want it. And then the Girl Scout said, oh, well, then how about $1 for this American flag or charity or something? And he found himself giving $2 for something he didn't want. He said to himself later, why is it that I gave up that money so easily?
Because it's a cute little Girl Scout at your door giving you doe eyes, and you're like, oh, God. It's a right. good. You end up justifying it to yourself eventually, right? Oh, it's a good cause, and yada yada yada. Yeah,
right, right. So, to each of these facets, author Cialdini offers a way to try to combat it, as difficult as it may be. And on this one, he says, if you sense that the original offer was a trick, you can't say no to all of them. But if you sense it's a trick, then mentally redefine everything that's been given to you as a sales device. It's no longer a favor. It's no longer a gift. It's no longer an obligation. It's simply a sales tactic or sales device. And you no longer need to respond, with a return favor.
You can spit in their face.
Well, maybe that's going a little
too
far.
That might be a little too far. Yeah, you're right. You're right. That's not... All right, so what's next? What's another one? That was one.
Right. So the next one is consistency, which is the idea that once we have taken a stand, we're going to behave in such a manner as to justify and remain consistent with our earlier decision.
Okay.
And, of course, that makes sense. That's a benefit to us because in society, those who are consistent with their ideas are seen as being logical and rational and being stable and being honest.
And we're seeing the opposite of that right now, of course. We love to hear politicians talking about flip-flopping. It just seems like it's every single day you hear that crap.
Right. And what do we really want? Do we want a politician that when they get new data, they rationally think about it and make a decision? Or do we want one that has made a decision at age 21 and has taken the same stand throughout their entire life? Or do we want somebody like our Supreme Court justices who basically have said nothing ever, and so we don't know? Sorry.
That's okay.
Getting off into politics.
No, but that's a good reason why engineers aren't in politics, I'm sure. Too logical.
Right. So the advantage of this, it's a shortcut for us. We don't have to think too much every time we hit a new situation. Something's presented to us. Do we have to evaluate it all over again? Do we have the emotional stress of deciding what we believe? No, we're consistent with what we did before. No problem, no fuss, no muss. We move on.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's a consistency is basically it's a habit forming activity, right? I mean, you do something the same way all the time. It's easy. You don't have to think about it. It's humans are habitual animals. So I think that's a very big part of it.
Right. So in Cialdini's research, they went and they made phone calls to people and they asked them, would you be willing to contribute time to a charity? Now, most people, they get a call like this. They want to do the socially responsible thing. And so they go, well, sure.
Okay.
So a couple of weeks later, other researchers would call and ask these same people to donate time to a live, real charity. Just by calling 2 weeks before and asking for somebody to say they would contribute time to a charity.
Oh, okay. So the first question was, would you ever, basically? Would you ever? Okay.
And people wanting to be seen in a good light said yes.
Of course I would, yeah.
Now when they got called 2 weeks later...
With
an actual charity, because they'd said yes, they felt, to be consistent with their own self-image, they had to say yes again. So the number of positive responses increased sevenfold.
Wow. So that's if you're asking someone out on a date, you should call them 2 weeks before and be like, would you ever consider going out on a date with... engineer, and then and then 2 weeks later you call and you say, what's going on?
Maybe not a bad idea.
All right,
if you can get commitment, if you can get somebody to write it, to say it, to act it, to do it,
yeah,
anything that makes them take action, and better that it's written down or they take action than they just say it, then people feel a commitment.
Interesting.
I mean, if you're a guy and you're trying to get a girl that you find attractive to go out with you, when you try getting them to go out to dinner and they don't want to go out to dinner, you go, oh, just have coffee with me. You know, anything small, just with the idea that if they will just sit down for 5 minutes with me, they may see me in a different light. And more important, they've taken action which says, well, I went out for coffee with him, he must not be such a bad guy, because I would never go out for coffee with somebody who was evil or cruel or mean.
Right, and if the person is evil or cruel or mean, usually that person figures out during coffee, right?
Right,
spilling coffee on other people and not tipping waiters and waitresses and such.
And in for salespeople, they're taught, you know, start small, get any sale, get any
right.
Contract, get any response.
Yeah, the first sale is walking in the door kind of thing, right? It's just being able to shake hands.
Excellent. So if you've agreed, a salesman calls and said, hey, just let me come in and show you what I've got, and you say yes, you've taken an action that says something about, well, this salesperson is worthwhile enough to let in the door.
Right.
That shades your viewpoint and reaction to their product and their company. Maybe slightly, but it does shade it.
Right. And that's why I always just hang up on them immediately. As soon as they say, would you ever, I go, click. Not really.
Right.
It's interesting. You can actually, I mean, you can work this in reverse too. So we were talking about this from the engineering perspective, right? You can work this in reverse because if you're talking to a vendor and you're asking them to, try and maybe help you with a problem that you're working on or something like that. I mean, that they want to be consistent. Obviously they're trying to, help serve their needs as well. But, there is the other side of this as well, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. One of the ways you can work this to reverse is one that in a different book, the same author talks about a method that Ben Franklin noted in his journals, which is to get somebody to like you better, you can ask them for a favor.
Really?
And so because they want to be consistent with the favor they've done, they will see you in a different light. So Ben Franklin would go to people that didn't like him, and he would ask them for the favor of them loaning him a book.
Interesting.
And then he would return the book and say to them, thank you so much, and if I could ever return the favor, please do. But what he found, he makes notes that once someone has done you a favor, they're more likely to do you a favor in the future because they have to remain consistent with,
right.
Well, if I loaned him the book, he must not be that bad.
Right, exactly, yeah. It's like that self-image side of things as well. Man, we're getting into social engineering here, Jeff. I mean, we're in hot water here, I think.
Well, that's why one of the reasons I just wanted to bring up the book is not that we're not going to solve all these issues, but I just want engineers to be aware of them. They don't even have to go study them. Just from make observations day to day, you'll see this stuff going on around you.
Oh, definitely. Oh, yeah, every day. You're right. Any social interaction is littered with these kind of things, and is never. It's always under the surface, I think. I mean, it's always, some people are scheming, but most of the time, unless they're a really smooth operator, you're going to figure out what the heck's going on. And so, yeah, I don't know. It's part of every social interaction. So it is, like you said, it is good to know what's going on.
Right. So if you see this and you feel like you're being your sense of consistency is leading you down a path you don't want to go, the countermeasures that are suggested in this book is to tell people that you're aware of the consistency principle. That is, they've sort of forced you into this corner with the expectation that you're going to be remaining consistent. If you identify it, say to them, I understand what you're doing. You've put this here with the idea that I will remain consistent with my previous decision, but it's no longer logical. It doesn't make sense, and I'm not going to do that.
Right.
And pretty much once you've identified that you're onto the scheme, that sort of deflates their ability to use it against you.
So would that be like... I know that you came in and shook my hand as a salesperson. I know where this is going.
Well, I guess you could. Sometimes you have to let the salespeople speak just a little more because, sometimes the salespeople do have something that you do need.
Oh, I know. I experience that daily. But
there's the sales guy that I worked with at the machine shop that I used to work with had some sort of thing about a guy that's in the middle of a battle and turning away the salesman who's bringing all the new guns and weapons and saying that I don't have time to talk to him now. and so, it's that balance. And I don't know a good way to tell people how to find that balance on their own other than just sort of be aware of what's going along and what's going on around them and keep their eyes open.
And it's a gut feeling eventually too. I mean, yeah, I mean, young engineers are going to get burned by it because it's you're never going to learn this in school. First off, because salespeople don't care about students for the most part. They don't control any buying decisions and
They don't have any money.
They don't have any money. Yeah, and that's cool. So this is something that, you know, you learn when you're on the job. It's just, you know, you have to learn. You learn how much more engineering is usually about people. I mean, it really is. I mean, it's not all about people. Obviously, there's still a lot of technical sides of things, but I mean, just dealing with buying and selling and you know, interacting with others. It really is a different experience than you ever would have thought if you were just in school. So.
Yeah, and many companies now, when I started, you had, for any purchase, you had to get everything signed off. You know, I couldn't spend a penny without having a manager sign off on it.
Right.
But they've fired so many levels of intermediate management in the past 20 years that pretty much a lot of companies are now giving engineers at all levels some sort of, you know, credit card where they can spend 100 or 200 or 1,000 or 2, you know, whatever their limit for their company is.
Yeah.
And suddenly you have spending power that doesn't require sign off. So now the vendors are going to come looking for you because you do have some ability to spend money.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's true. And you know, and one last point about this consistency side of thing.
Uh-huh.
I find that it's most prevalent for stuff that I do when it's, you know, when you have very equivalent solutions. So in my case with like distributors being people that, you know, buy a whole bunch of parts and hold them for you and then they sell you like bits and pieces of those parts is at some small margin.
Right.
There's really, I mean, like if you look at all the big ones, they're all pretty much the same. It's more based on preference and, you know, personal relationships and everything else. I could go to a great number of them. It doesn't really matter. And so, you know, you'll see this a lot with, at least in the electronics industry, of, you know, vendors trying to maintain relationships because these are important things. You know, they have small margins, so they have to work really hard, but a lot of that is relationship building and you know, offering help here, offering help there, and I mean, yeah, it's just a something that happens.
Yep. And these relationships that the vendors, the salespeople want to maintain, it helps their business. But the reason it helps their business, I mean, they may have a desire to have a personal relationship with you because they like you as a person. Mm-hmm. I'm not discounting that may happen. But there's also this sense of what this next principle that Cialdini talks about, which is liking. That is, we like to do things for people that we like.
Right.
And so we have, there's, you know, so the question is, who do we like? It makes sense that the people, we would tend to like people who we think would return the favors. The idea of reciprocity that would be consistent with that obligation, return the obligation. So it makes sense from a sort of how do we do it as a community standpoint. But the downside is that those who know how to sort of manipulate our feeling for liking someone can influence us in ways that we don't want to be influenced.
Right. Yeah, definitely. And this is becoming more of a prevalent issue. Not necessarily in the engineering world, but just more in the world at large. I mean, you see corporations trying to have this effect now as well with, you know, social media and everything else. And I mean, obviously the one thing is Facebook is likes, right? I mean, like likes on Facebook, but that doesn't mean you necessarily like that corporation, but more generally they try and, you know, gain your trust and gain, they want you to like them as a company so that you're thinking of them first when you start to have a problem. That's the same kind of thing, I think.
Right. Right. And it goes, it's a consistency. If you've liked a company, then when you go to the store and you go, well, I liked them on Facebook, I guess I should buy them here.
Very possibly. Yeah. So what about, this is kind of a nebulous topic, I think, the liking, you know, like why. I understand that I you know, people that I like and I know that I want to help out, right? I mean, friends that I've worked with in the past, I want to help them. But why? I guess there's a whole range of reasons why I might like someone, right?
Right, and there are reasons that we typically overlook, that we're not even aware of it, or we would say we would never be biased by that, but almost everyone is.
Right. Yeah. We're still human.
And we engineers are especially susceptible to this thing because we think so often that we're rational and logical in our work, our technical work we are, but we're still people and we are very much subject to this. And so sales types can often sort of leverage this stuff against us, so we're not even aware of why it's happening or how it's happening.
Right. And you might actually experience this too in the office. I mean, you might have, you know, when there's cliques around the office, that kind of thing. I mean, people gravitate towards other people that they like around the office, and they help them out. So if there's a, you know, if your boss plays favorites, or, you know, if that kind of situation, there could be, it could work for or against you in that case, right? It's, you know, there can be buddy systems at work where you might experience this, and it could be good or bad.
Right. And if you're not aware of why people like one another, you may be sitting on the outside going, I don't understand what's going on here.
Right. Yes.
So we can't, in our little podcast, we can't help you figure out how to get into that circle, but we can just give you a few things to look at to say, if you're on the outside, what is going on inside that circle that I don't understand? And if you're in the circle, how might I be more effective in communicating with those around me?
Yeah.
So I'll not take too long here. I'll just go through six items that influence the degree to which we like other people.
Mm-hmm.
First one is physical attractiveness. Now, we usually say, oh no, I would not like someone more just because they look nice.
No, there's been tons of studies on this kind of thing.
Tall men are more likely to be CEOs.
That's correct. Overweight people are less likely to be promoted. I know that.
Right. Good-looking men climb to the top of organizations better. Good-looking women, if they're not too good-looking, tend to climb to the top of organizations. For some reason, those that are model-like looking sometimes have trouble climbing to the top of organizations. They get paid better. They get better outcomes in court.
I saw this funny anecdote about that on how to be successful. It was on Reddit. It said, rule mm-hmm. one, be attractive. Rule two, don't be unattractive.
Right.
Yeah, it's sad, but
right,
you can't overcome it. It's just a crappy reality. So
it is.
Let's move on.
So number two is similarity. So if you may not be able to change your, you know, I guess surgery, but you may not be able to change your physical attractiveness, but you can use similarity. And this is what good salespeople will do. They will dress like you. They'll talk about interests that are the same as your interests. They'll bring up issues. If you were born in you know, Kansas and they were born in Nebraska, they'll bring up that you were both born in the Midwest. If you're both about the same age, if you have the same religion background, whatever it is, they're often taught to what they call mirror and match. That is, if you lean back in your chair and cross your arms, they're going to lean back in their chair and cross your arms. Right. If you tilt your head to the side, they're going to tilt the head to the side.
Yep.
The key is to not do it so blatantly that it's obvious you're sort of mimicking someone, but to do it just enough that it kind of looks like someone's looking in the mirror.
Yeah.
They're seeing themselves. And guess what? We like ourselves.
Yes, we do. Yeah. This specific comment, I mean, a lot of this book is kind of an add-on to the famous Dale Carnegie book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, which is another good book. That's from the 30s, I believe.
Right.
And but this one is specifically, the mirroring is a very big thing in that book. It's a very big concept there. So,
right. And the some of the sales training that I went through, one of the, you know, the first step was when you go into somebody's office, it was look around and see what, you know, if you see a golf trophy, talk about golf. If you see a fish up on the wall, talk about fishing. Immediately.
I hate when people talk about sports.
Okay. Well, whatever it is, you know, find something that is important to them and start talking about it to share an interest.
Yep.
We like people who are like us.
Yep.
We like compliments. We're suckers for flattery, even if it's not true.
Yeah, it's weird. It works, though.
Conditioning. We like someone that we see a lot. So the salespeople like to be on the grounds all the time. But it should be a favorable response. So if you're in your boss, if you want to be liked by your boss and you're in your boss's office all the time, and that's not positive. It's not a positive emotional period for your boss.
Again.
Yeah, then that's not good. You want to be in your boss's office reporting good news on a frequent basis to make your boss like you. The conditioning is good, but it has to be with a positive emotional experience.
Right.
Cooperation, the idea that if someone comes to us and says, hey, we're going to pull together.
We're all in this together.
Right. So the salesman may do battle with his management. You go, I like him because he's trying to be on my side.
Right.
Or the old good cop, bad cop, where, you know, the good cop is going, don't pay any attention to him, kid. You know, I'll help you. I'll get you a good deal.
Yep. I'm going to go get a cup of coffee.
Right. And we like those with whom we can associate and get reflected glory. So people tend to become enamored with sports teams because they get the glory when the team wins, or they'll buy stuff because of the athlete's endorsement, because they like the way the athlete performs, or the way the celebrity looks on the screen. It seems as engineers, we kind of go look at this, I think, and say, are people in general so shallow? And we have to go, yes, they are. And unfortunately, that includes us. That's
I know, us too. It's terrible. But this happens even with engineering stuff. I mean, if I saw Steve Wozniak promoting something, right? It's an engineer I respect. I'm going to pay more attention to it. It's just a natural human characteristic. There's always people you look up to. There's always an association, a positive association you can get from someone like that. So, yeah, it's you just got to learn to deal with it.
Right. And just as a final note, there's an effect that's sort of related to this, which is called the luncheon effect, which is we tend to become fonder of people and things experienced while eating.
I cannot refute that, that's for sure.
So politicians tend to ask for money after the meal because people have become fond of them during the meal, and then will give more if you ask for the money after the meal instead of before the meal.
And sometimes they serve beer with the meal.
And sometimes that too. And so we enjoy going out to lunch with people we like. That's why someone who's trying to sell you something is going to offer to take you out to lunch a lot, not only because of the sense of reciprocity for the meal, but we tend to like those that we have a meal with.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just being human again. I feel like we should name this episode How to Be Human.
So how do you combat this? Well, again, it's hard to combat, but if you find yourself liking someone a lot more quickly than you normally like someone,
if you find yourself when an offender comes in and you immediately propose marriage to them, it's probably too fast.
It's probably a little fast, and it's time to separate the individual from the deal. Remember that you can like the individual, but the deal that the individual is offering, that's a whole different thing and deserves its own little bit of rational thought.
That's right. Yep. And if you took the deal away from that person, would you still take it? If you were being sold at by someone you didn't like specifically.
Right.
Yeah. That's an important test.
Right.
So what's next?
So the next one is authority, and that's the idea that we're trained from birth that obedience to proper authority is right and disobedience is wrong.
Hmm.
And it makes sense. The benefit to society is you want people obeying the policeman in the street.
Hierarchies, yeah.
And you want if the Surgeon General says don't smoke, then it's probably a good idea for the populace at large to pay attention to this authority figure and say, okay, maybe we shouldn't smoke.
Mm-hmm.
But the downside is people can appear to be authority figures when they're really not.
Mm.
And this happens, I think, less in industry. You know, we're not dealing with, outside, inside the walls of the company, we're not really dealing with policemen. We're not really dealing with, religious authorities or doctors or other people that we'd meet outside the company. We're sort of all together in this, and the authority is who is managerial level. You know, the CEO and the president are going to be at the top of that, and the lab assistant is going to be kind of at the bottom of the structure, and we kind of know what that authority structure is within the company.
Yeah, but sometimes you will see this when in a sales call, a salesperson might bring their boss in, and they have some extra weight behind it or something like that. I'm authorized to give you the best deal possible. I need to go right. talk to my manager, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Right. Right. And so people who do that, we respond to three levels of authority. We respond to titles. Mm. So someone's a VP or a director, you know, we'll pay attention. Even though if we've never seen them before, we don't know anything about them. The fact they have a nice title,
right.
we're going to pay attention to
them. You're going to take their business card at face value, right?
Right. If someone, the second one is clothing, we pay attention. Why do you think everybody wears suits? You know,
except for Chris.
Except for Chris, and I certainly don't. But suits are normal wear in a lot of situations because it's a uniform. It denotes authority.
Mm-hmm.
In research situations, people wear lab coats, the same sort of thing.
See, now I wear lab coats because I'm usually, when I'm cold in the lab, it's usually the best reason to wear a lab coat.
That's one good reason.
Yes.
You can't just start a fire with your soldering iron and sort of, you know, get everybody to sing around the campfire?
No, I'm not that resourceful.
And the third thing that denotes authority is the trappings of authority. You know, you'll see somebody driving a very nice automobile or having their office, you know, with very expensive decor.
Mm.
I mean, if you go into a bank lobby, why do you think all the bank lobbies are you know, have the big marble pillars? It's to denote this sense of authority, give you confidence that they know what they're doing with your money.
Right. So how do I get around this then? How do I... You know, if someone with an authority looks at me and says, well, this really is the best thing for you, I mean, maybe I'm likely to listen to them.
Well, the two questions you can ask yourself is this person truly an expert? Are they can claim to be an expert, they may have the title, but are they truly an expert?
Hmm.
And the second one is, even if you believe they're an expert, how truthful do you expect the expert to be in this situation?
Right. Like, what's their angle?
Right. So, for instance, with the big financial scheme with Bernie Madoff, he was definitely an expert. He knew the financial workings of Wall Street, but he had a situation, you know, how truthful could he be? Well, he was funneling it all into his own pockets. At least that's what the courts decided.
Right.
So, People who are experts may have their own motives, and I guess it's just the moral is to be aware and keep your eyes open.
Definitely. All right, four down, two to go.
All right. The next one is scarcity. That is, we are far more sensitive to possible loss than we are to equivalent gain.
Right, loss aversion. This is a very strong... This is actually a big part of investing as well.
Absolutely.
People are much Absolutely. More likely to sell a losing stock than they are to buy a losing stock because they don't want to lose any more, whereas oftentimes people know buying stocks low is the best time to buy.
Right. The problem is that our response to loss and gain is asymmetric.
That's right.
We have a huge fear of loss and a not-so-large appreciation for gain.
Right. Another way to think of it is the fear of missing out on something.
Yes. And... sort of the, if you read kind of between the lines of Cialdini's book, it's not the loss and gain alone. It's the loss that has, or the gain that's been taken away.
Right. Oh, if only I would have, if I would have purchased that part 10 months ago, I wouldn't have to pay all this expedited shipping and whatnot.
Right. So we... You know, being attentive to scarcity is good. You want to see when opportunities arise, they may not arise again. You know, That's the right. guy says, I can sell you these parts this week for 50% off because the plant is shutting down next week and we want to unload this inventory before the new stuff comes in. That may be a once in a decade opportunity to help your company out. You don't want to necessarily walk away from it.
But you don't want to jump at it right away either. That's the first thing he says to you.
Right. Right. So you'll see things like, you know, we have a limited number, you know, buy now because we only have a limited number of these things.
Right. And that happens a lot more in commercial or in non-engineering situations, right? Car sales and commercials right. buying situations, right?
Right. And so in those situations, one of the things to be careful about is that the salesperson may say to you, well, if I can find one, are you interested? Are you ready to buy one if we can find one?
Right.
Well, the scarcity may have been true or artificial. They may immediately go into the back room and find one for you. And now, because of your sense of consistency, you feel obligated to go ahead and buy it, whether right. once you see it, you really like it or not.
Right, definitely. And yeah, it's not great. That's not a great way to be forced into buying something, that's for sure.
Right. So those that are deceitful may bring you into a situation where they bring you up to the point where you just about have the service, the item, the device you're looking for, and then just about the time it's all going to close and you're going to sign on the dotted line, then suddenly a new buyer, a new bidder, a new competitor, a new something comes up and it's taken away from you.
Right.
And that it's that sense of loss. We had that abundance. It was almost ours and it's been taken away. And now we'll do just about anything to get it back.
The dreaded eBay last minute scramble.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I've been a victim of that before and I've paid way overpaid before.
And there's nothing worse. Well, like, there are many things worse. Certainly, you have an empty feeling. I've been through that, where you'd bid on something with 30 seconds left, and you'd get down to 5 seconds left, and you go, "It's mine!"
Right.
And then
$200 extra,
and then somebody throws in a bid for 50 cents more and gets it with 3 seconds left.
Right.
Oh.
Terrible. Terrible feeling. Yeah. That's the thing. Like, we can recall it right now. Right. It's a tangible feeling. It hurts, right? It's like, oh, I could have had it,
right?
And in the end, you probably wouldn't have wanted it anyways, right? I mean, because it's eBay.
Exactly. Yeah, there. I've got a few things around here that I wish I had time to sell back on eBay.
Real stinkers. Yep, I have it too.
So as we're saying here, this pursuit of scarcity produces an emotional response. You know, it's a fight or flight type. I gotta have it. I gotta do it. So if you feel that arousal coming on, that emotional state, then start to think about why you're feeling that and look for a little rationality. Try to consider why you might feel that way.
Right. And ask if you actually need it too, whatever that thing is. I mean, if it's a sale, right, you should always try and be able to walk away with it, kind of thing. But I mean, I don't think, like I said, I don't think this happens as much in an engineering context. Maybe in a... maybe within the office it might happen more, right? Well, you know, I have the solution, but it's not going to work anymore. So Jeff's solution is longer term. We should really try my solution now because it might go away soon. That kind of thing, right?
Right.
But other than that, I can't really imagine what else. How else it would be relevant to engineering?
I think more in the sales part, where I've bought items where somebody says, hey, we've only got one of them in stock, or you got to buy it now or we won't have it back for 3 weeks, that kind of thing.
Okay, so like a scarcity in the stock room of there. Okay.
Right.
Interesting.
Okay, so are you ready to hit the last one of our six?
I think so.
All right.
Getting up there in time, so that's good timing.
All right. So the last one is social proof, which is the idea that the greater the number of people who believe an idea to be correct, then the greater the likelihood that the idea is, in fact, correct.
Hmm. And evolutionarily, this makes sense, right? I mean, it's a tribe type thing. It's if the tribe feels it's good, then it must be good. But not necessarily.
Right. Well, we turn to this most frequently when we're in a state of uncertainty.
Yes.
What we just don't know what else to do, we look around to see what everybody else is doing.
Yeah.
So if you're in a restaurant and you don't know whether to use your knife and fork or pick up the chicken and eat it with your fingers, you're going to look around to see what everybody else is doing. Whatever they're doing, you're going to do the same thing.
I just go for broke and I put my face to the plate and just start gnawing away.
If you're trying to figure out how fast to drive and you don't see a speed limit sign, you're just going to drive as fast as everybody else does.
Yeah.
It's that social proof. You're going to look to see what everybody else is doing.
Right.
And it has the benefit that in many cases it prevents you from making bad decisions and the occasional bit of social embarrassment.
Right. Now, I can think of a very significant engineering side of things where this is a bad thing, I think, most of the time.
Okay.
So you're in a new situation, you're developing a new product. Maybe you have a couple competitors, right? And you get to a precipice where you have to make a decision. And then what always ends up being said? Nothing?
We need more information.
No. What's the competition doing? Let's just do that. You never heard that before? It's just, what's the competition doing? So sure. Usually that's the social proof, and then they say, and do a little bit more than that. I think that's the ultimate example of engineering product development is, what's the competition doing? We need to be a little bit better than that. And maybe you should be ignoring that thing completely, or maybe you should be trying to, blow that spec out of the water, but it doesn't matter because the social proof is, if it's good enough, then it'll compete. And I think that's a definite downside. I mean, I've never liked when that happens as a marketing thing, as a product definition kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that tacit groupthink, I mean, it's it's really industry think, but and groupthink happens at companies as well, right? I mean,
it happens all over the place,
right?
When people are uncertain about what to do, they look around to see what everybody else is doing. You see a slew of movies about a certain subject or of a certain genre because somebody made money with them. People are guessing as to what the next hit movie will be. When they're uncertain, they do the same thing as the last one.
Right. Yeah, that's again a loss aversion kind of thing as well. I mean, we might not make a lot, but we won't lose a lot either. And
right. We've got our hindsides covered because who can blame us for doing the same thing as the last one that made money?
Yeah, and actually a loss aversion anecdote that I always like too is it's actually a stock thing. It's with regards to technology. The saying goes, nobody was ever fired for buying IBM. Right. So IBM stock was, it had periods throughout history of doing very well and periods where it did very poorly. But at the same time, everybody else was buying it. Every other stockbroker was buying it. And you never get fired for taking that risk. And really it wasn't a risk at all at that point because it was so big and so many people owned it. So you never get fired for owning IBM. That was kind of the saying. And I think that's a good example of both social proof and loss aversion.
Right. Yeah, so you can be kind of aware of, if you start looking around, it's all the signs of social proof all over the place. Why do you think they have laugh tracks on sitcoms?
Right.
Because when we don't know whether something's funny or not, we're influenced by other people that we've never met before laughing on our TV. We tend to think the show is funnier. That seems silly, but all the research says that's the case.
Right.
If you look at politicians talking on the TV, you'll notice they always have a group of people standing behind them.
Yeah.
Why do they have that? Because we perceive that, if there's a group of people standing behind them on TV, then there must be more people that approve of their policy and we should like it. And if we're uncertain, we may agree with them because of that that influence.
Right. You know, from the engineering side, I actually have some pretty direct experience with this. And, people always hear the term, it's better to be first than to be best kind of thing.
Right.
And that's like on a product side. But actually, even within a company before, one of my mentors, he always told me that it's important say you're trying to get a decision made within a product group. You're trying to, figure out the best microcontroller to use. Right. Oftentimes, it's best to offer one of the first suggestions and then have people build consensus around that. And just because it's first and not necessarily best, I mean, that's actually a very important thing as well, but being the first suggestion is actually oftentimes the end suggestion just because you end up building consensus around it. So either, if you have a certain solution you really want to implement for whatever reason, it might not be that you have to, if you're third in the lineup for, whatever, you're going to be compared on whatever specs it might be. But if you have some other reason that you really want to get something implemented, oftentimes if you're the first solution, you're going to be the final solution. So again, that's a thing you could use for good or evil, I think. But in terms of a good example of this, I think that's a pretty good one.
Absolutely. People all these six items, people are influenced by them. We are human. We can't get away from it. As you've mentioned, you can use it for good. You can use it for evil. I'm not preaching either one of those. I'm just saying, as engineers, be aware that there are these things going on in the social world around you, and it's not all the technical issues that you're dealing with on your desk on a day-to-day basis.
Right. I think you'll see this as well with consensus building, right? Maybe you'll have a 20-person, you'll be in a 20-person department, and you know that a decision is being made on Friday. Well, oftentimes there's someone going around and trying to build consensus beforehand, right? So you can recognize this and either ignore it or combat it or whatever you want to do, really. I mean, but oftentimes you will see that behavior before, you know, a big decision is, it's not decided on the spot. It's decided beforehand, and it's decided with consensus and oftentimes with influencers like that are going around and collecting consensus. So that's kind of the crux of it all.
Right. And so if you're going around and asking people, hey, if I get my policy or I get my idea out in front of the vice president, will you support it? Then if you can get them to say yes, then they have this sense of, you know, now you've got a sense of consistency. They've said yes, so they must act on it. They've taken action, so they want to be consistent with that, with their prior action. You can do some things to sort of prime the pump so that when it comes time for people to support you in the meeting or in the presentation, that they really will do so.
Yeah, I think even just, offering for feedback on an idea, right? You know, if you go around and ask 10 people for feedback on your choice of a part, right? You're going to get 10 opinions, but you're also going to have people that offered you that opinion. They're going to feel obligated to support you in that opinion likely later. I mean, unless they're good engineers and they actually analyze it, right? I mean, if all things being equal, if it is a decent solution, I think that they'd be likely to support you over a similar solution that was offered by someone else. I mean, again, this is in a situation where all of the things are equal, right? If there is an obviously better case, then oftentimes engineers will pick the better case. But
right. If your solution requires testing in Nevada,
okay,
and the VP knows that he's going to have to go out and watch these test periods, and he can spend some time in Vegas, and he likes going to Vegas, then he may lean towards something just because of the benefits of the offer.
Right.
But right, like you said, if all other things being equal, then these biases, these influences can guide the decision.
Yeah, these are what really tips the scale, I think, when it is an equivalent situation, right? And I mean, you can see this in tons of different situations when you're being sold to as well. Oftentimes vendors will have, not even like for chip vendors, you won't even have people that are selling similar solutions. They'll be selling the exact same chip, right? They'll either license a intellectual property, or it's an old school chip where they used to make the exact same chip, and what did you really go with then? And there was no reason to pick one or the other. So oftentimes I'm sure salespeople were using these six methods to try and influence people because they had the exact same solution.
If they were smart, they did, because that's the way you make sales.
It is. And as much as, you know, I'm sure people are listening right now and they say, oh, I hate sales, right? And I used to say that. I mean, I really did. I used to very much dislike, I used to always think it was dishonest. For some reason, I don't think it was a parental thing. Don't worry about that. but I always thought, oh, well, I can't believe people, you know, leverage their relationships for this kind of stuff. But I don't, there's always some defining aspect of, you know, when a sale is being made, there's always a reason for it. And it's not always a technical reason. You can't always just go on data alone. And good salespeople are there in order to, when all things being equal, are, you know, to make the sale, like you said, Jeff. And so, you know, if you don't like salespeople, recognize these six things and go with whoever doesn't do this. But you're probably the only person buying from that person that doesn't do this.
Right. I think that you can't avoid these six facets of influence, just be aware. Just, you know, start to recognize them in data. It's not like you're going to have to look far to see it going on. So that as it happens once or twice, you sort of learn the trick. You know, when you hear a joke the first time, it's very funny. About the third time you've heard the joke, it kind of loses its funniness because you know what the punchline is.
Right.
Well, the same thing with the various guises that these facets of influence come in. You'll see it. You'll see how it's used. You'll see how somebody approaches it, how somebody presents it to you. And then once you've seen it, then it's no longer effective. You're not going to laugh at the joke anymore because you're not going to fall for it. And I don't even know that falling for it is really the right word. You're just going to be aware of it, and you can take appropriate action based on that awareness.
Right. I think a good example of that would be, say you are offering a solution that you know you've tested is better than, you know, say that it's you and someone else in your department, and you're both offering this solution, and you've done testing to know that, you know, the solution you're doing is better. But you see the other person, you know, using some of these techniques in order to try and sway decisions for whatever reason, and at that point you can appeal to people's data side, right? I mean, you can show that things are actually have a reason that they're better, right? And then if you point out some of these influential tactics that people are using, oftentimes people will snap out of it and actually do a real comparison, and that's the best you can hope for. If people don't snap out of it, then your organization is doomed.
Right.
Not really, but you know.
Well, one of the things that you were talking about, sort of the engineering aspect, we have to realize that we're a small percentage of the population. Not many people have been trained to think in such a way that allows them to consider how the physical world operates and how to make it do things the way, you know, to manipulate it to do things the way we want it to. We want them to work. So if you don't have that, you're left in a different world, in this case, the social world, and we're all familiar with the social world, and these people who don't know how to manipulate things the way we do in the physical world have to earn their living and have to make their place in the world using the talents they have in the social environment. So I guess I can just say that as an engineer, I feel grateful that I have an understanding. I'm able to view the world in such a way that I can see how things could be made to work in the physical world. But I also have an appreciation for what people are able to do and have to do to make a living in the social world.
That's right. What is that saying? If you have a good idea, you don't have to worry about giving it away. Oftentimes you'll have to shove it down people's throats in order to get it implemented. That was a very big paraphrase, but
but that's absolutely true. Yeah. It's not, we always worry about giving away the perfect idea or the perfect concept, or somebody's going to steal it from us. And usually if it's really a good idea, nobody wants it at first.
No, definitely not. if it's truly radical, right? I mean, it's going against the social proof, right? I mean, if 16 companies are using solution A and you're trying to offer solution B, you're going to have a hard time selling because there's no one to social proof against. So
right.
Yeah, it's all in there.
Right. And in a few weeks we'll talk with a guest about patents. And so we can get into that concept of how valuable is an idea and how much money should be willing to spend to try to protect that idea.
Definitely. All right. Any other thoughts on influence?
No.
I'm not sure if I want to go shower and not think about influence anymore, or if I want to go sell something to someone. I can't decide.
Well, sell first, shower second.
Okay. All right, well, Jeff, I got a great opportunity for you. I'd like to what's it going to take for me to get you into this car today? Let me go talk to my manager.
Well, if that would be a good, was it reject and retreat? So go talk to your manager and say, come back and say, well, I couldn't sell him on that idea, but for just $200 more, I can throw in a remote start kit.
Right. Make it a flying car.
Ooh, that'd be good.
Yeah.
That'd be worth $500.
All right. All right. We'll talk to everyone next week.
All right. Take care.